Yeah, perfect. So why don't
Recording now.
yes, it is. If we'll give it another 10 seconds for people to vote, and then I'll share with you the results of what people have said. So that will set the tone for today, today's talk. So I will end, I think, a good 25 out of the 30. Seven people have voted, so let's end the polling pretty much now. Okay, so there it is. Can you see the results? Let me share results with you. Okay, so here are the results. 24% of people are new to PACE. We'll tell you what PACE is about. Only 14% of people have not had a virtual visit in the last 1 year. That is amazing for what has happened to virtual care. And most of you found it to be convenient. It was faster access. It helped you. None of you said it did not help you in virtual care. That is impressive. I had no idea how people would respond to that question. And for 5%, it was difficult, and 15% said, I would rather see my provider in person. So that is interesting results. I'm sure our panel would be will be weighing in on that. So I will get rid of this poll. So for those of you who are new, PACE stands for Personal Assessment and Change Education, and it started off as a practice improvement initiative many years ago. And it was about having a conversation with a group of people, conversations that are peripherally related to medical care and involve integrative medicine. Over a period of time, it has evolved from 10 to 12 participants in the Northumberland Hills Hospital boardroom to now virtual, with at times there have been more than or around 100 people attending. The supporters of PACE are obviously the Northumberland Hills Hospital. Jennifer Gillard, who is here, is pretty much the anchor person over a period of time, who has coordinated a lot of it. Jennifer Gilmer from the Northumberland Hills Foundation, which is a supporter of PACE. The Northumberland Family Health Team, with Adrian Bell-Smith, their executive director. Community Health Centers, Taryn Renix, who is also today one of the speakers. And I'm from IM Care. So the principles of PACE are that there is no sponsorship, there's no payment to the speakers. Everybody is volunteering their time every time. There is no cost to attend, and it is like self-sign up, and there is no incentives or donuts to attend a meeting. It is about come on, learn, and share. These are supposed to be conversation starters. This is not medical advice. The things that the moderator will, these are moderated discussions. Things we don't discuss is politics, government policy, or hospital policy, or why somebody's not doing this thing or that thing. This is to keep it pure and literally have a conversation. Our audience literally tells us after every talk what they would like to hear in the future. The group meets once a year, figures out, and we try to get local experts or local people to speak on this. And today is a very different day for PACE because, we all talk about patient-centered approach and how do we do it. And so far, in the last 4 to 5 years of PACE, always the speakers and the moderators have been somebody with subject matter expertise. Today we said, what would it feel like if the questions were asked by the patient themselves, if we were talking about virtual care? So with that in mind, we asked Bill Prevecki, And you, Bill, can you wave so that people know who you are? So Bill is a patient family, is a part of the Patient Family Advisory Council at Northumberland, but he is passionate about spreading education about different things that relate to healthcare. And he will be moderating the conversation with with the people who are sort of experts in, or will give you their opinion on virtual care. And so at this point, Bill, I'm going to turn it over to you and I will take a back seat. And Bill, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Bhargava. Jennifer, can we get the first slide, please? Or Jen? Okay, so first of all, I'd like to thank Dr. Bhargava for providing me the privilege to moderate the session tonight, and also thank all the folks that are on the PACE Talks tonight, and a special thank you for the guests that have taken their time to help us out tonight. Just before I introduce the speakers, I'd like to set out the scene for tonight's session. As a patient and former caregiver, this topic has been of great interest to me. And most recently, myself, I've experienced virtual care with my own doctor. So as far as virtual care, there's a huge, huge study that took place and was published in February of 2020 by groups of medical association, et cetera, and physicians. And they defined virtual care as any interaction between patients and our members of their circle of care occurring remotely using any forms of communication or information technologies, with the aim of facilitating or maximizing the quality of care. Okay, so that's really a mouthload or a huge amount of words there, but virtual care is what we're entering in this new environment now. Next screen, Jen. About a week ago, if you subscribe to the Toronto Star, they had an interesting article in which they indicated that the virtual visits jumped 5,600% during COVID. And it's quite understandable, as a lot of folks couldn't access their doctors and had to use either a phone or other means. Just as another article just came up the other day, where they're now using virtual ER at Sunnybrook and a few other hospitals. And if you read the articles, it's quite interesting because they're in a 6-month trial. From initially, they have had 400 calls, they use Zoom. And most interestingly enough, the fact that only 25% of the people, the 400, ended up in the ER. So in essence, they took care of quite a number of folks, almost 300. So that's really a movement in a new direction. So for tonight, what I'd like to do is, there'd be three areas that we're gonna cover tonight. We're gonna talk about virtual care, the history and the challenges and benefits. We'll talk about patient privacy and security using virtual care. And we'll also have a practitioner's view and experience and point of view on virtual care. So any questions that you may have, let's save them till the end. And once all the speakers have completed, then we can open it up for questions. So I have the privilege of introducing the first speaker, which is Taryn Renix. And Taryn, I'll read the bio. Taryn is the Executive Director of the Community Health Centers of Northumberland. Has worked in the healthcare and post-secondary administration for 20 years with a background of fine arts and experience in leadership, corporate services, and information management. Taryn enjoys being a part of creative and innovative solutions. She has a strong appreciation for digital solutions and virtual healthcare options. Taryn feels that a priority in healthcare should be ensuring that patients have a positive experience in order to ensure high quality care, and now more than ever, virtual options for healthcare or healthcare is vital. So Taryn, Jen, if you can get Taryn's first screen, then I'll pass it over to Taryn.
Perfect. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Thank you so much, Bill. And thank you everyone for joining us tonight. This is a really interesting topic that, as Bill and Dr. Bhargava pointed out, was actually a choice of previous PACE participants. So this is really exciting that we get to address this topic, which is very prevalent right now, as I'm sure everyone is aware. So I'm going to talk to you a bit about the history of virtual care, because it's not actually as new as we think it is, or we like to take credit for. Some of our current generations we think that we live in the age of technology and we are responsible for a lot of what's happening now. But virtual care, by its true definition, has been occurring since before the invention of the telephone. During the Civil War, actually, the military ordered medical supplies and transmitted casualty lists and diagnoses by telegraph. In 1879, which is just 2 years after the telephone was invented, telephone consultations occurred with physicians simply out of necessity. In April of 1924, and I will draw your attention to the magazine cover, that is an image on this slide, for radio news, they were actually foreshadowing telemedicine in a depiction of a radio doctor linked to a patient not only by sound, but by live picture, which was not available at the time, but is rather ironic when you think about virtual care as we know it today. And I do want to point out a pioneer in virtual care in Canada, Dr. A. Maxwell House, and he is not in any way affiliated with Maxwell House Coffee, but I did look that up. He was Newfoundland's first neurologist. He was a psychiatrist first and then became a neurologist later. And in the 1970s, so all those previous instances of virtual care, they were done out of necessity, but Dr. House decided that a deliberate, intentional way of providing virtual care was necessary to provide specialty services, neurology and psychiatry, to remote and rural areas using telemedicine. So I think that's really fascinating because it's actually, virtual care is not that new. Jen, could I have the next slide, please? Thank you very much. So we're going to talk about what virtual care looks like today. Virtual care has rapidly evolved, mainly because of COVID-19. The definition of virtual care that Bill overviewed with you is very similar to other definitions of virtual care from different research papers and hospitals, et cetera. And you can look back in, you can Google it, and you'll find many definitions from 2014, 2009, 2005. And yet here we are in the state of a public health crisis, and we were all advised to stay home in order to stop the spread of this pandemic. Yet medical consultations and interventions cannot stop. We need our healthcare. And as time has gone by since the pandemic started, we've noted the effects of social isolation on people and how that is affecting their emotional well-being and their mental health. And so we have phone consultations. They are one of the most convenient forms of virtual care, one of the forms that people are most comfortable with. And then we have video visits, which I know many of you will be aware of, using platforms such as Ontario Telemedicine Network, DoxyMe, and Microsoft Teams. They're really popular in medical practices. They're very safe and secure, which Simeon will be touching on. Other platforms, like the one we're using right now, Zoom, are used where privacy is less of a concern. I do want to quickly touch on telehome care, also not a new technology, but a great method for doing remote monitoring of specific conditions, such as COPD. The patient experience in this instance, so there's remote monitoring devices that a patient has at their home, and physicians and specialists are able to receive information about the patient's condition. And what this does is improves the quality of life for the patient by avoiding hospital stays and unnecessary trips to the emergency department. And finally, email communications, which is a bit of a tricky one because of privacy legislation and concerns, particularly in the province of Ontario. There are some risks involved with emailing personal health information. So, as a patient, we need to respect whatever policies the care provider's office has in place. Many offices, I know we've spoken about email communications locally. Many of our offices will use email communications for things such as appointment times, reminders, or program offerings, but we tend to avoid emailing personal health information because of privacy and security concerns. Next slide, Jen. So Just a few facts about virtual care. Bill touched on a few of these already, but they're really quite fascinating. And a lot of studies are being done now and will be done long into the future to assess the value of virtual care versus traditional practice. COVID-19 has presented healthcare challenges for so many of us, but technology has improved access, and 7 out of 10 Canadians reported that they had sought medical assistance during the pandemic and had a virtual visit. So interestingly enough, the poll that Dr. Bhargava provided at the beginning, your answers were right on with that. 9 in 10 Canadians say that the pandemic has shown them that virtual healthcare can actually be important and valuable, whereas we were all very hesitant in the beginning. And 98% of patients reported that they felt e-visits were the same as, or perhaps better than, an in-person visit. And we'll talk about that in a minute when we discuss benefits. Next slide, Jen, thanks. Another study was just showing that, this was actually the same Toronto Star article that Bill was alluding to that came out earlier this week. And again, a lot of attention on virtual care. But office visits dropped by almost 80% since the beginning, so March 2020, the beginning of COVID-19. And as Bill noted, virtual care visits jumped by 5,600%. And next slide. Okay, so what types of appointments are available virtually? Visits with your primary care provider, such as your physician or your nurse practitioner. I know a lot of local primary care practices, including the one here at the CHC. We have a lot of telephone consultations going on and video consults when it's either necessary or patients are comfortable with it. You can have initial consultations or follow-ups with a specialist. You can have a visit with your diabetes educator. Mental health and addictions counseling is working very well using virtual methodologies. Nutritional counseling. So we've been offering actually dietetic and nutritional counseling here at the CHC using Ontario Telemedicine Network for, I think, 6 years now. So it's interesting to see how it's come to the forefront. Health promotion activities. And I do want to touch on this for a second because I did discuss social isolation. And we all know that part of wellness and well-being is connecting with other people. And unfortunately, we're not able to do that face-to-face in most circumstances right now. So when you have an opportunity to participate in a wellness activity, a health promotion activity, such as yoga, such as viewing a cooking class or cooking demo, it's a great way to connect with others and to keep yourself active in a virtual way. And another example of some virtual care that's being offered in the community is also smoking cessation. Next slide. Thanks, Jen. So challenges and barriers. This is really interesting. Access to technology is a barrier in the sense that some people cannot afford technology. They cannot afford a laptop, which I'm using right now. They can't afford a cell phone, which most of us have. Reliable internet service is also an issue. And provincially, the government is trying to assist in improving bandwidth in rural areas. Not far from where I'm sitting right now in Port Hope, we have some bandwidth issues and people cannot access reliable internet. Getting appropriate consent to provide virtual care. You will note that when you are doing virtual care appointments with a provider, there are consents that are required, and your provider may ask you to acknowledge and document that you are comfortable with the virtual environment. Of course, people are not all comfortable with technology, and not everybody trusts virtual care. Is it as successful and meaningful as an in-person visit? Okay. And benefits. So this is the positive side of things, which I always like to look at. Definitely there's convenience in virtual care. We've had many patients here state that they like the fact that they can do their medical visits from the comfort of their own home. It's reducing their travel time. And especially for people with mobility issues and transportation barriers. We are, of course, limiting exposure to infection and stop the spread. We're not congregating in waiting rooms and offices. In some cases, virtual care is increasing access to care. It's improving the patient experience. And of course, important during this time of pandemic, we are using less personal protective equipment in the offices. Okay, and looking at virtual care in the post-COVID world. So there are no guarantees how our care is going to stabilize when we get all the vaccines in the arms and COVID is no longer at the forefront of our daily lives. But the shift is not inevitable. I think there is a pendulum swing that needs to meet somewhere in the middle. We've found a lot of benefits, some of which I just alluded to having virtual care. But there's going to need to be shifts in thinking of all levels, the patients, the providers, and the government, in order to make a successful shift to post-COVID virtual care. So I think that's it for me. I'm going to hand it back to Bill to introduce the next speaker.
Bill, you're on mute.
It's one of the famous words on Zoom, you're on mute. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Our next speaker we have is Simeon Canev, and luckily, because of virtual pace, we can have Simeon attend this session. So Simeon is the privacy business lead at the Alliance for Healthier Communities, providing privacy and security support to 107, including community health centers, Aboriginal health center, community family health teams, and nurse practitioner-led clinics. Prior to joining the Alliance in 2015, Simeon has held privacy analyst roles in hospitals and CCACs. Simeon has graduated with a Master of Information degree from the University of Toronto with a specialization in identity, privacy, and security. He also holds a Certificate Information Privacy Professional of Canada, a Certified Data Privacy Solutions Engineer, and a Certified Compliance and Ethics Professional designation. Simeon, we welcome you to the talk.
Thank you very much, Bill. Much appreciate that. Hello, everyone. It's, basically that biography is just to say that I think I know what I'm talking about, but hey, nobody knows it all. So I'll try to be brief and just share with you a few things that might make your life a little bit easier and, you know, not become an easy victim of the many, many, many scammers out there that are using the time and the day and age that we live in and switched and changed everything in the previous ways we used to do things to this new way of living in COVID-19 and doing things virtually, remotely, whatever you want to call it. So next slide, please. What I'm going to try in the next few minutes is basically just give you an overview of the privacy and security considerations, and hopefully that information will come handy, will help you do better, and at least maybe it will inspire you to seek the answers to some questions going forward. This is just to say that this is not legal advice, so please don't take it as such. It's just really best practices when it comes to that kind of stuff. Thank you. Next slide, please. This is a slide that illustrates one thing that is really crucially important. It talks about the importance of client-clinician relationship, patient-clinician relationship, and not just the relationship, any relationship. It's the relationship of trust. You need to have the relationship of trust intact between those two. Otherwise, they won't be able to deliver the best care that you need. Now, this used to be the case until about mid-March last year. We see clients face-to-face. Click, please, Jennifer. This is what we do now. You see the client on the other end of a computer screen, or maybe you hear their voice on the other end of a phone line, but you don't really see them anymore face-to-face unless it's a really significant kind of like thing, that issue that they need to attend to, because most of the things that we do now have switched to virtual visits. You know, maintaining that relationship of trust is different in this situation when you don't really see the client right in front of you. And for those of you that have been in long distance relationships before, you know what I'm talking about. It's not quite the same thing. You really both need to work equally as hard to maintain that relationship of trust. I might argue that the clinician has to do a little bit better in that regard, and work a little bit more and stronger on this one. By the way, I typically provide that presentation always to the clinicians. So I'm trying to now modify it to fit, you know, your side of the equation, being patients. I mean, I'm being a patient myself most of the times, but I typically provide this to clinicians. So bear with me. The reason why I put those two guys underneath is because privacy and security considerations have to be taken into account, because bad guys, or, you know, the people that are there to make our lives more difficult, are not like, okay, we understand everybody is frustrated, it's COVID, we're not gonna hack anybody, we're not gonna spam anybody, you know, take a break. No, unfortunately, they're more active than ever before. And by the way, you might not like this, but virtual visits are both effective and efficient. No matter whether we'll go back to whatever the old normal was or not, quite likely, most of the things that we do, most visits will stay virtual because they are effective and efficient. And piggybacking on what Terian said, there are security and privacy considerations, but we should not take privacy as a barrier to effectively and efficiently communicating with our providers. Next slide, please. So here are a few considerations for you. Now, when you do virtual visit, you need to understand what you're getting yourself into. And there are a number of platforms out there. I'm not going to go into details, but the idea, the principle is the same. You understand that you're relying on someone else's software and someone else's account on someone else's platform to get in touch with your clinician. So have that in mind whenever you're sharing information. You're sharing sensitive information at the end of the day. So be mindful, and you provide that informed consent that you need. Ask questions. If you don't understand something, if you don't know where that information is stored, who has access to it, ask those questions to your clinician. If they don't know how to answer them, maybe ping their privacy officer. That's why there is a section in the law that says that every organization must have a dedicated privacy professional, privacy officer, that you can ask those questions to. Acknowledge those limitations to your audience, right? If you have like people all the time behind you, and that applies typically to clinicians, I was about to say my kids are at home and I'm alone with them. So if you hear a chatter and somebody storms next to me during this call, I apologize, but this is the day and age we live in. So acknowledge those limitations ahead of time. When it comes to secure transmission, you might want to send maybe a picture to your clinician, maybe something else. Be mindful how you provide that information to them. Ideally, you would password protect it, okay? Put it into a container, put a password on it, and then send it to your provider. Yeah, unless there is a platform involved that would allow you to do that securely. But if the case is you need to use an email or a text message or something like that, just mind you, do that properly with some protection in effect. Recording of sessions. Remember, you can record things. Nobody will stop you. But my advice to you would be, if you're to record a session, because you can do that on your computer, your provider might not know that you're recording. At least acknowledge that to them. Tell them, I'm going to record you if you don't mind. And this really is, and we know, because you want to remember what was said in the conversation. Just give them that acknowledgement so that this relationship of trust stays intact. And if other people need to be with you, at least acknowledge that to your provider. Make it clear that there are other people there for the reason mentioned earlier, that maybe they need to remember what was stated, because you might not remember what was stated in that conversation. Now, you might need to share your screen. If you're to do that, please make sure that you know what you're sharing before you share your screen. For example, if you have stuff that you don't want other people to know you've browsed for, don't open them. I remember vividly like a team meeting when someone was supposed to share their screen. They're sharing their screen, and the next thing we see is jobmonster.com searches for jobs, and they're sharing that with their boss. And right underneath it, how to ask a female colleague on a date. Okay, obviously, you might need to check what you're going to share before you share your screen. So be mindful of that. Now, one thing that I get quite a lot of questions about is, how do I know whether whoever is contacting me is really my clinician? Well, you know, if you're not sure and they give you a call, maybe it's a scammer. You don't know that. Maybe ask them, can I call you back? Because you know the number that you can reach them at. Or maybe ask them for a piece of information that if they are really your provider, they will know the answer to. Not something simple as what is my date of birth, things that you can find on somebody's Facebook profile, but something that they would only they would know. Know the limitations of virtual visits. Certain things can and certain things cannot be addressed in a virtual visit. My dentist said, I would love to do my job from the comfort of my couch, but that's not how dentistry works. So, you know those limitations. And this is a word of caution. When you're to use free things for free, like software packages or some sort of, you know, interesting thing that you found and it's free of charge, when you don't pay for a product, you and the information you provide are the product. You should have no expectations of privacy or security or both if you're using stuff for free. So please be cognizant and careful when using stuff for free. Next slide, please. Now, a few things about cybersecurity. Now, you might not be so tech savvy, but maybe you know someone that is, that might help you with this. Just make sure that the internet connection that you use at home is secure. Your pass, you know, your access to your internet is protected with a password. If you use Wi-Fi, there is a password on that Wi-Fi. These are all things that you can ping your internet service provider, whether that's Rogers, Bell, or whatever other company might be. Just give them a call and say, I heard the guy speak about this. Can you help me with this? Okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Asking questions is a good thing. And think about all of these things that might come to affect your health and the information that you provide. At the end of the day, you're thinking, who cares about my information? Well, there are a number of people out there that could use your information for nefarious purposes. So be mindful of that. Next slide, please. I hope nobody has fallen asleep yet. I'm doing my best to keep you engaged as much as possible. So next slide, please. Now, when it comes to information security, mind you, you use computer devices. You probably use a tablet or a laptop or the old-fashioned desktop, whatever it is that you use. Make sure it's up to date. The antivirus, the endpoint protection, the operating system, they're all up to date. All of those providers issue those updates that are necessary for the system to work safely, to be patched from vulnerabilities. So make sure you do that. Click, please, Jennifer. So if you're using Windows 10, for example, on your laptop or your computer, good, just make sure it's patched accordingly. If there is a new update, you update it. Next, click. If you're still using Windows 7, please upgrade from that because that is no longer supported, okay? A year ago, they stopped supporting that, meaning anything you do on your computer could potentially be hacked and compromised way easier because it's no longer supported. One more click, please. And if God forbid you're still using that thing called Windows XP, okay? I know friends and people that still use that. That came into being in 2001, that's 20 years ago, went out of support about 5.5 years ago. Please don't use anything that uses that outdated piece of software. So mind you, you need to use proper equipment and proper software when doing all of this work, when doing virtual visits, when doing online banking or any of those wonderful things. One more click. Now, probably to get into this session, you needed to put a password. To get into your Access bank account, you need to use a password. To get into your virtual meeting, perhaps, you need to put a password. Let me tell you about passwords. They're like underwear. Click, please. Don't share them. Please don't do that. Don't you share your passwords. They're for you to get into something very sensitive. So don't share them. Next click, please. The longer, the better, okay? A simple password of like 6 characters is not good enough. You need to have something a little bit more complicated, a little bit longer for a password to be safe. Click, please. Don't leave them hanging around, okay? Like clothes, don't leave them exposed like sticky notes at the edge of your computer. Bad idea, don't do that. Click, please. Example, right then and there. Next click, please. Okay, change them often. No password is too good if you keep it for too long, okay? You need to change your passwords occasionally, every now and then. Another one, be mysterious, be unpredictable. That's really a key message when it comes to passwords. Don't make passwords of name of your dog and maybe date of birth or something like that. Things that can easily be guessed from someone. One more click, please. And one more. Okay. Password managers are writing things down. Nothing wrong with writing passwords down, okay? But don't write them in a way that if somebody finds that little piece of paper that you wrote them on, they can compromise you. Not like Facebook, username, password, email, username, password. Write them in a way that makes sense to you and to you only. Write them in another language if you may. Write them in Klingon, High Valyrian, Dothraki, some Elvish, Dwarvish, some other language, but plain and simple English. Okay, next slide, please. What does all of this mean to me? And I realize I'm a little over my time. We've seen this dramatic increase in people moving to work from office to home, doing things presumably primarily from the comfort of their home. A lot of people feel anxious and frustrated and uncertain. And hackers, spammers, all of those bad folks are loving this, right? Because that's when people are more likely to be compromised. So if you have questions, ask them. Okay, there's no such thing as stupid questions. There's stupid answers, but they're not stupid questions. Be vigilant, be cognizant, be aware. One more click, please. This is the email address you can reach me on, privacy@alliancewon.org. I'll be happy to provide you with my 2 cents worth of non-legal opinion if you email me. That's pretty much was the end of my presentation. I think I was just a few minutes over. So thank you.
Can you hear me? Can you folks hear me? Yeah, okay, great. I'd like to, the next person I'd like to introduce is Dr. Aaron Pepper is a family physician in Coburg, working at the Coburg Medical Center. Dr. Pepper does hospital inpatient care and obstetrics at Northumberland Hills Hospital. She is a medical director of the Northumberland Family Health Team and sits on the health team of Northumberland. Another great bonus for us is that Dr. Pepper was raised, born, and came back to be a doctor in Northumberland. So over to you, Dr. Pepper.
Hi. So I'm going to start by saying I am in no way an expert in virtual care. Like many other doctors, I had to become one very quickly. I'm going to also show Simeon that my office Wi-Fi password is on a sticky note on my laptop at the moment because my staff had to bring it to me. Also, many of us in March of 2020 were working from home with kids behind us, with figuring out the logistics of insecure, or you know, not necessarily insecure internet, but internet that wasn't always reliable. Some of Simeon's short phrases in his slides, like VPN, and you know, it all became a new language for many of us really quickly. And it was a transition. We recognize absolutely that it was also a transition for our patients. So hopefully this will just give you an idea of how that transition was for us and where we're at now. So in March of 2020, we closed our office suddenly as the pandemic was announced. We had already been screening patients on the coming in since the end of January. We'd been wearing masks, patients with symptoms had been wearing masks, but suddenly we couldn't bring anyone into the office. So it was a very rapid transition. There wasn't any time to learn to have Zoom meetings with Simeon, which did all eventually happen. There was many platforms we spent a lot of time learning over the course of the initial couple of months of the pandemic, but it really happened very quickly. And it happened by everyone at the same time. So there wasn't figure out how this works and disseminate that. Every physician, in order to provide care to their patients in March and going into April, were trying to figure this out independently. And everybody therefore may have a slight different approach to virtual care based on their initial comfort level, whether they were doing any element of virtual care initially, platforms that they're used to, and just their comfort with all of these platforms. And many people in this transition, many of us in this transition were doing, as I said, we're doing this from home, but it was happening across the country and around the world simultaneously. So next slide, Jennifer. How does it work? So you're still going to call your family doctor's office to book an appointment. And I still have patients that I reach out to today, 11 months later, saying, I didn't know you were working. I didn't know how to get you. We are working. We've been working since March 13th. And our staff are still answering the phone in every office. Some staff may be at home, but however, each of those offices has made it work, and it's all a little bit different. but we're still there. You may not see our face. There may be some video visits where you get to do that. But overall, you're still going to call and you're going to ask for an appointment in the same way you did before. Hopefully, the access to that appointment is faster. Certainly in my office, it is. My understanding is for most physicians, access is quite a bit faster. You're going to be given a time. We make every attempt at calling you at that time. Sometimes, depending on how offices are working, sometimes I have in-person appointments booked amongst my phone calls. And in order to keep patients moving through the office, we try to prioritize the people that are in the office so that they're not sitting in our waiting room. So if you are waiting, please just be patient. We are going to get to you. Depending on, you know, certainly my experience in the first few weeks of the pandemic, when I was at home with kids running around in the background, my timing was quite flexible. We know that that's been difficult with patients, and we certainly have transitioned to trying to stick to a schedule as sort of laid out in our calendar. But we're going to give you a call, ideally at the time that, you know, as close to the time that's booked. We are going to introduce ourselves. We're going to use your name as we have it in our system. As a primary care provider, it's quite different than the specialist. I generally know your voice, even if I'm not seeing your face. You generally know mine. And as Simeon actually highlighted, not in his presentation, but to us the other day, people can actually create that. If anybody was ever concerned about whether it's a provider, you know, whether it's their provider, we would be more than happy to help you feel more secure about that. Whether that's a phone call back, like Simeon said, or highlighting some, you know. And, you know, by question, we generally, I can't speak for everybody, are confirming consent to provide virtual care. 11 months in, when we've spoken to some patients multiple times as a primary care provider who does longitudinal care, I may have had 10 virtual visits with someone, but Simeon certainly has been a good reminder that each of those visits needs to be re-consented to provide virtual care. We're going to do our visit. We're going to take a history just like we would in the office. The part that's lacking is the exam. Sometimes we're actually asking you to do some elements of the exam on the phone or on video. Obviously, if it's a video, we're watching what you're doing. But if it's on the phone, sometimes we are asking, does your, you know, if you bend your knee, does it hurt? If you push on a spot, is that causing you pain? Is it causing, can you feel the back of your hand? And the answers to those questions are really, really important. We do feel that we're getting a lot of really relevant information when we're talking on the phone, that history, you know, a really complete history can give us a really good picture of what's going on. It certainly does not replace all physical exams. And we certainly recognize that. We know that you're missing that. And we really do want to provide whatever we need to, which is why if we need to bring you into the office, at that point, we will. And sometimes I will actually do that in the same day. So if I've spoken to you at 10 o'clock in the morning, I will very frequently say, can you come by at noon? Can you come by at 4? And try to make that as flexible as possible to the patient's day. Some of my, you know, I can't speak for every physician that happens same day. We really base that based on how urgent something is. A really good example is if you thought you had a bladder infection or what we call a UTI, we would invite you to bring that urine sample into the office same day, next day, or to the lab based on your comfort. So there's lots of different options and everybody's doing things a little bit differently. But I think in the end, we've certainly come a long way in 11 months. and we're continuing to adjust how this works. I just wanted to highlight one element of of virtual care that Taryn mentioned, being telehome care. It's being used for COVID, as the pandemic has shifted, as there's been more cases locally, we are actually doing telehome care for COVID patients, where oxygen monitors are actually being dropped off at patients' homes, and they're being monitored by home care nurses through a secure app or through our new community paramedicine program, which was launched this year through our Ontario Health team. So that has been really effective and really positive for patients with COVID. Next slide, Jennifer. So we recognize that some things work better virtually than others. What has worked well for us? Mental health. I remember particularly in the spring thinking that my mental health teens were talking to me. In the office, we rarely see their face. They typically look at the floor. But virtual telephone is their medium. And so they were actually speaking. And I thought, it really struck me in April that we were really able to make headway in that population. But across the board, this is a population that although I'm sure are missing our face, we have really been able to manage virtually. Results, amazingly, we're being supported in calling you for results. Sometimes we ask for that to be at a set time and it becomes a visit. We discuss more than one thing, depending on the results available and what else, where else, when we last spoke. And sometimes those calls are happening at the end of days or at other times when we need to get a hold of you for results. But this is, we feel for the first time, really supported in being able to provide results to patients by phone. Diabetes, generally, with using glucose numbers, using lab results, adjusting blood pressure, we can adjust these medications just as easily as we can in person. There is some big elements of diabetes care that's not necessarily being provided virtually. Foot assessments is probably the biggest one to highlight. But if we include that in our conversation with patients as we're talking about their diabetes, hopefully patients themselves are able to identify when they have concerns, and providing first options. So really what we're trying to do is provide you with some symptom control, trying something out. If that's not working and we need to bring you into the office, we will. But on first pass, for an injured knee, for a rash, providing some first ideas is really working virtually. If those symptoms aren't improving, it's when it becomes a little bit more difficult and we may or may not need to bring someone into the office. Blood pressure obviously is on the side of being more difficult. My conversations have shifted to, this isn't going away and maybe you should think about getting a blood pressure cuff. Obviously that's not possible for everybody to purchase. We're supporting whoever we can with prescriptions for this if they have coverage. But we've really encouraged as many people as can to be monitoring their blood pressure at home if they have a blood pressure cuff or can get one. Obviously, dermatology has been something that's been more tricky. Lots of people ask whether we can do this by video so that we can see their rash. But the reality is you really can't see well. And so we're trying to do this with pictures. And, a high quality picture by email has been significantly easier, better than by video. There's obviously the security issues of email. And this is one of the one things we are using our secure email platforms for. Or our more secure email platforms. And we do usually have that conversation of no email is 100% secure and that we're gonna delete the picture from we're going to delete the picture after we've looked at it. We now have some method of inputting your picture to our EMR, our electronic medical record, which has, if you were seen in person, we wouldn't be saving a picture. We haven't in the past saved a picture of your rash. And so now we have, you know, some really great ways of being able to compare things. Severe symptoms obviously become quite tricky. And there's no shortage of people that we are sending to eMERGE because something sounds severe, but that's no different than if you've waited till your appointment time and come into my office with chest pain, I am still going to send you to eMERGE. So acute cold symptoms clearly are not being seen in our office, but we've managed to, many of our primary care providers, whether that's nurse practitioners or family doctors, are actually providing that care in our COVID assessment center, and really want to see, it's our chance to actually examine sick patients. And we've all surprised ourselves at how much we have missed that. So severe symptoms and acute significant illness sort of go hand in hand, but follow-up, not improving symptoms, also I'd include in that list. Next slide. So who is coming to the office? And I just preface this by saying it does vary by office and by provider within a single office. And it's changed through the pandemic. In the first few weeks of the pandemic, nobody was coming into the office. Everybody was canceled. Phone calls that could be made were made. But even our babies and our pregnant women, we didn't know how to manage this. In the first couple of weeks, it took us a little bit of time to figure out how we were going to bring, you know, how we were going to space people out, bring in who needed to be seen, who did not. So the first people that were brought into our office were our babies that obviously had to be seen. Vaccinations for these babies were made a large priority in the pandemic. And pregnant women obviously needing their obstetrical care. So for those of you who know me or my practice, that's obviously a big proportion of in-person visits at our office, as there's four of us who provide obstetrical care here. And we actually initially did things quite differently. We shared, all of our pregnant women in on the same day of the week, and one provider saw them. So rather than multiple providers seeing a few patients through the week, all OB patients were brought in. We used the entire office at once, and we were able to see quite a number of people quite efficiently because we actually were able to use sort of every 15 minutes into a different room. We've now gone back to seeing our own babies and pregnant women here, as well as at the hospital. So vaccines and injections, like I said, the babies were a big priority. Some vaccines and injections were prioritized more than others through the pandemic, opening up and closing back off as needed. Obviously, during the fall became a really big priority for primary care offices. If we feel we need to examine, we are bringing people in. So ideally after a phone call, but in the summer, patients were able to self-identify that they did want to come in for whatever their need. But in general, a rule of thumb, if we're bringing someone in to examine, we've had that conversation. So most of the time we've already spent on the phone. And so if I'm bringing someone in to examine their knee, for example, that really should only take a few minutes. And how we're framing that to patients is, you know, we've had our conversation. We're going to examine for a few minutes. If it's a quick conversation to wrap up the concern and make a plan, then we're doing that. If it's another long conversation, again, we can finish that up over the phone if we needed to. But our in general, we're trying to keep these in-person encounters to less than 15 minutes. That's generally what our public health partners have been saying increases the risk of COVID-19 transmission. Whether that advice changes as variants start to appear, we're not quite sure yet. PAPs have been done by varying amounts throughout the pandemic. We were initially informed or recommended to not be providing any PAPs. We then were able to ramp this up as things opened back up again. And it's not something that closed back off during this most recent lockdown. IUDs, I think, also varied by office, but certainly lots of us felt that that was still a really high priority, particularly in some populations. And we did continue to provide that care in our office. Seniors unable to participate in virtual care for whatever reason that is, sometimes it's cognition, sometimes it's hearing, their ability to use the technology, you know, these, but as able and as they wish, in our, it's particularly in the summer. And others who wish an in-person visit. So obviously, if there's something that you're concerned about, you're concerned that things have not been recognized or you're missing an important piece by not being examined, bring it up with your provider. We want to be able to provide the care that you feel most comfortable with. And only during our most strict lockdowns have we been more firm sort of with a phone visit first. Next slide, please. So what is hard? We miss seeing your faces too. We know that you miss seeing ours. We know that there is an element missing of therapeutic touch or just being here in the office and being examined. I often say I've been surprised at how much I'm enjoying working in the COVID assessment center on my physician assessment days because I get to examine patients. And so we do really miss having you here. As many have said, virtual care will be around for a long time. It is working for lots, but there'll be a shift back to in-person to a large degree of in-person care as well as time allows. We spend a lot of time convincing of the safety to seek care. So whether that is coming to our office, sending to eMERGE, ordering lab work or diagnostic imaging, you know, there are a lot of patients that are still quite worried about various elements of the healthcare system, which are, you know, all have really, really good measures in place to keep patients and staff safe. And for care that's needed, we are encouraging it to be provided. Not having family attend appointments, I think we've highlighted that virtually, we actually have more opportunity for some of this virtually, as long as everybody's aware of who is present. Sometimes with the technology, you know, if sometimes the technology has made this a little bit more difficult, but has also given us the opportunity to have those visits with other family members and from further away than family in town would be able to attend. A few new things. I mean, I recently had a learner start, and that brought a whole new set of element of difficulties to virtual care, which we thought we were sort of getting the hang of. You know, now having a resident make those phone calls. Like I said, you know, the familiar voice is missing. For the most part, our community has been really open to that. We've always been a teaching community. So that is, you know, that is out there. And one of the hardest things has been, you know, noticed in the spring, when we were calling from home in unmarked and unidentified numbers, and it comes back to that, you know, as Simeon said, patients wanting to feel secure that it is us calling, but calling from an unidentified number certainly makes that a little bit more complicated. So I think that is the end.
Yeah, Dr. Bhargava, do we have time for some questions?
Bill, you are the boss tonight.
Hey, no, okay, no, just the timing. First of all, just in summary, thank you, Taryn, for letting us know that in 1879 they didn't have Wi-Fi. Simeon, you really woke me up with that slide. And to Aaron, that post-it note, get pink ones. They work better. Okay, but I really appreciate what we learned tonight. A lot of stuff. Hints on security. There's just too much to digest, but I really appreciate what the folks have brought to the table. I had a couple of questions just to start off, and then we'll just open it up. A couple of questions that were directed to us by Jennifer, Daryl, and Sheridan Van Blaricon. So I'm going to pick a question, and I'll kind of point it at one of you folks there. So Simeon, I don't know whether you watch US TV and all, but it's a dime a dozen. There's all kinds of companies popping up. They're virtual care companies. Okay, one of them advertised 2-minute waiting time. What should we be looking out for from a security and privacy issue when people are zipping around looking for all these super duper opportunities?
Oh my goodness, I'll need another half hour to explain that. But in a nutshell, see who is behind that platform, whether it's a reputable company. Do a quick Google search, see on their website what they advertise in terms of privacy and security, because there has to be a section on this. And if you feel comfortable, maybe do a little bit of search for reviews on that platform. You know, right? Ask Google, basically, how is that platform rated or something like that? And if you're not happy with what you see, don't go for it. Maybe ask someone else that you know that might have used that. Simply, I think that will sum my response up, because I don't want to go into more details. I think that would suffice.
Taryn, being in a community care environment, the question came to us, how will seniors and low-income families without smartphones and strong technical skills manage?
That's an excellent question, and it's something that all offices locally are facing. I know that from our experience, what we've done is, obviously, if people are not able to manage the virtual world, we're going to make it happen. We're going to go to them. We're going to have them come to us, and we're going to do it in a safe manner. So we have screening protocols in place to ensure that people who are coming to the office are, symptom free, etc. And if in the case of people with mobility issues, frailty, etc., in some cases we are going into the home. Technology can be a barrier for people in virtual care, but the bottom line is we have to make sure that the care can occur.
Thank you. Aaron, I usually go in for an annual checkup, a full physical. So virtually, how is my doctor going to check my pressure, my temperature? So the question is, how does a doctor get vital information like heart rate, blood pressure, temperature, oxygen levels? Are we there yet? And what are we doing?
Yeah. So first, I'm going to start by saying the evidence for a annual physical actually isn't existing anymore. And so we prefer to call them a periodic health review. And to be honest, most of that review is talking now. So it's going through the cancer screening that you need. What have you seen? What specialists have you seen in the last period of time? So a lot of that can still be done virtually and by speaking, and we are certainly happy to have those reviews over the phone and make a plan for the next 6 months, 1 year. What has most evidence in terms of a yearly exam is simply blood pressure. So without symptoms of temperature and oxygen saturation, none of those things actually need to be done in someone who is symptom free. So we're asking, as part of that review, we're doing a review of systems and asking, do you have shortness of breath? Do you have a cough? Do you have chest pain, palpitations? And performing the exam that's required related to that. So we are still getting quite a bit out of those annual reviews if patients are still wishing to have that. Again, like I said, blood pressure is the hardest one of that. And for someone on medication, we're certainly encouraging them to get a monitor at home.
Yeah. The only reason I ask is every time we travel, the insurance company asks, have you had your medical?
Right. And we struggle with that question now because we're actually not providing yearly medicals as readily as we used to, even before the pandemic.
Okay, great. So let's open it up. to the folks that are on the call too. Are there any questions that anybody would like to pose to one of our great speakers here? Jen, do you see anything? For Mark, where do we see virtual care going after COVID?
I can take that one if you want.
Go ahead. Yeah, anyone else?
Perfect. So we actually don't know, Mark. We definitely see it continuing. I think there have been many benefits provided by virtual care, some of them being, for example, I mean, OTN, Ontario Telemedicine Network, started long before the pandemic and has proven to be very successful in reducing travel time for patients. You know, we're able to have people set up here at the hospital or at the family health team or here at the community health center locally and seeing a specialist that is many, many, many kilometers away. So I think that the pandemic has proven that virtual care can, you know, it's shown us a lot of the benefits. It's not going to go away. We don't have a concrete answer, and there's going to be a lot of research and evidence needed to be collected on what the problems are with providing virtual care, you know, where the gaps were versus what all of the benefits were. It won't go away, but I think I mentioned this about the pendulum. It's going to have to swing and balance. So we're going to have to wait and see a little bit, but it's not going away.
And the question I have for Simeon. Simeon, the question that was posed to us, why do we need a GP at all? With AI and all, with the technology and in the business you're in, do you see progress being made where you can self-produce your own diagnosis? And then I'll open it up to the three of you, but Simeon from doing research and all.
Where do I see that? I mean, that's already there. There is a computer called Watson that IBM, I think, developed. And that thing is pretty good in answering legal questions, medical questions, you name it. Like artificial intelligence and machine learning are kind of like the way to go. And we see that quite likely, as soon as maybe next year, you'll be seeing some of that available. I mean, lots of conditions can be diagnosed simply by using information already available to those algorithms and that is available from research. Of course, not everything, but the vast majority of things could potentially be addressed by a computer or machine or something like that. So I can see that coming pretty soon.
Can I address that, Bill, from a primary care perspective? Just to highlight from a primary care perspective, either the AI or the virtual care providers being provided by sort of some big industry. The important thing to realize is those individuals don't have your specialist reports. They don't have, so there's the element of being that receiver of all of the information and how to put it all together. That is where your primary care provider is going to take things forward.
Good. So Dr. Bhargava, you have anything to add?
Right. So adding to the question of whether artificial intelligence will replace, it's everybody talks about this. In fact, I have kids who are in this field of artificial intelligence and others. I think the future will be that it will enhance, it will decrease the inefficiencies in medicine rather than replace. It is almost so far impossible. Yes, a chest x-ray can be read by a computer, but what does that mean to a patient? Still requires the Aaron Peppers of the world. That, what do you do with it? So I don't think it is either or. I think it will be augmented. Just like you are carrying a phone now, it has artificial intelligence in it. Our COVID screens have intelligence built in it, which helps the doctors which person to test or not to test. So it'll be interesting to see.
Anyways, in summary, I'd like to thank the three speakers for taking the time And Simeon, you didn't have to travel out our way, but hopefully you will pop in to see us one day in Northumberland. And to Dr. Aaron Pepper for the time that you've spent with us, and Taryn and all the other folks that helped us out. Dr. Bergava, anything else you want to add?
Sure. So I would say, like, again, thank you. And you heard, like, as you hear these people, you almost say, wow, what, you know, what are the different dimensions? You have Taryn Renix, who has to figure out how it will run in an office. Aaron Pepper has to figure out, you know, how do I still keep the personalized approach to things? And Simeon talked about how do we keep, like, how do you know that the person who's calling you and saying, I'm Dr. Bergava, is really Dr. Bergava, because you have no way, voice signature can be done and those things. So we are very fortunate in our community that people have embraced it. Like when we did the poll, it was, 70 to 80% of you have had a virtual visit. Here are a couple of things that I would say that are valuable. Aaron touched on this, is monitoring people at home. If you learn anything today, is there is more access to healthcare now than what was there before. The physicians, nurse practitioners are seeing hybrid model of technology that they can see you through the phones, et cetera, but they are also seeing you in the office. COVID monitoring is happening at home. So if you have a COVID positive test, a nurse could be calling you every day or every other day and take some objective measurements. That is a LIN-based program and through our paramedics. We have also added specialists from the GTA and beyond. Like the average wait time for neurology was 1 year. We have brought that down to less than a month by leveraging this. The other question that had come up was, what if somebody doesn't have this? At the hospital, we have what we call the hosted OTN model, where there's an OTN booth, there's a nurse who can, you can just show up at the hospital, but the doctor may be somewhere else and you could be seen. And that is very secure, that is aided, and that is the future. We have one in our office where if I'm not there, but my staff is there, my team is there, they can help. So this is about trust, as Simeon had said, that trusting on both ends, the patient, the doctor, and the system. So that is what it is. But we'd be interested in hearing from you as to what you have in mind and where do you see the pitfalls be of virtual medicine, because we need to learn those from everybody. So over back to you, Bill.
Anyways, I'd like to again thank everybody for those that were on the call with us, the questions that we received, and certainly for the three individuals that did a phenomenal job. So again, thank you. And Dr. Bergava, I guess the next pace, we're looking for ideas, or did you want to say anything about the next pace?
You have the list on pacetalks.com of topics that are there. If you don't mind, drop a line what you would like to hear next. And we would like to rotate because, you know, we things in different dimensions. So drop us a line of what you would like to hear, or if anybody has a new idea or a speaker, please send them to us by email or drop them, whichever way you feel comfortable. So that is what I would say. I hope you enjoyed it. And personally, you know, Taryn, Aaron, and Simeon, and Bill, thank you very much for taking the time. Jennifer Gilmer, who did this, and I think Jennifer Gillard, are you on the line, Jennifer? I see you there. Jennifer Gillard is really the backbone of this in getting all of us, together. So thank you, Jennifer. Okay. Let's call it a night.
Good night, folks.
Thank you. Good night.
Thanks again.
Good night.